Hello.
Hey, it worked.
So you have to be, if you're not logged out of the app, it just takes you to your own podcast.
Oh, so you have to be logged out of it.
You have to be logged out of it for it to work. Yeah. But here we
If
are.
people are if people are wondering, like, huh? What are they talking about? She was having a hard time logging in.
Oh yeah, I'm not tech savvy at all. But here we are.
Here we are. So, the Good and Bad Podcast Show. I am your host, Jeff Malice Etienne. And it's been a very long time since I think the last podcast I did was in September. Listen, I'm a busy man. I actually have a life. Most people who podcast, that's all they do. So, I can't do that. But, can I use you now? I always ask. Am I allowed to use your name or do you want a code name?
Oh, you could use my name. That's totally fine, but I do appreciate you asking for sure.
All right. Sheena Giordano.
You got it. That's me.
Ha! Italian like a motherfucker.
Just a little bit. I am grateful to be here and I want to thank you for inviting me. Especially since it's been a while since you have podcasted, so it's an honor.
I appreciate you, saying yes to it and, and coming on.
It's a very worthwhile topic, and I feel like having the male-female dynamic to it really does help give a broader perspective. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's lacking is taking time to really understand each other rather than just being so kind of in your own way of doing things, which for a lot of people hasn't worked, and for a lot of people still is not working.
I agree. I definitely agree. But you know what, though? Before we get into all that, right? Tell everybody about, because I didn't know this about you. I found this out, I want to say maybe last year or something like that you're recovering what?
So I am a recovering addict and alcoholic, and it's one of those things where once you go on that path, you start to unravel so much about yourself and so much about who you are as a person. And I love the name of your podcast because some of it's really good and some of it's not so good, right? And so
True.
when you
Yep.
start to identify the quote unquote bad parts of yourself, and I don't even view them that way anymore, to be honest, because I think it puts such a negative connotation. It's just more like reflecting on the parts of you that cause you to be reactive and get triggered and not respond in a way that's really truly just congruent with your higher self, like who you truly want to be as a person and how you want to show up in this world. And alcohol and drugs for me was just a way to mask a lot of pain and just cope with life. And I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Oh yeah, a lot of people definitely could can relate to that. Many, many, many people. So what were you a recovering addict from?
So when I was in my mid-teens, it was a lot of different type of, experimental drugs. I was on a lot of pills, a lot of benzos. Definitely smoked a lot of weed. And it was funny because when people are like, weed's the gateway drug, I don't necessarily agree with that. It really just comes down to what you have access and exposure to. And so for me, I just at a very young age had access and exposure to a lot. And I always just wanted to fit in. So it was kind of like if I were with people that were doing something, I tried it just to fit in. And once you start trying other things, that's when you start kind of chasing the high because it's no longer enough and you always want more. And so I kind of stopped that into my early 20s because that's when I was like, okay, I'm an adult now. Like I have a professional career. I really shouldn't be messing around with this stuff. And so at that point, it was really just alcohol. And this is the thing that I will say. There's so many stigmas around alcoholism because you think that you have to fit like this traditional, alcoholic profile, which isn't, it's not true because on the surface, people would just look at me like, oh, you're just a social drinker, right? That's the way I was labeled, just a social drinker because I had a full-time career. I had a house. I had really great friends, you know. So basically, my life was pretty full. But on the other side of things, what some people never saw was that it was like a coin flip in terms of how alcohol would impact me. And the best way to describe it is if I was already feeling happy or elated about something, alcohol enhanced that for me. It made me happier. It made me fun to be around. And if I was already feeling sad or depressed or lonely or whatever negative emotion I was feeling, alcohol also enhanced that. I mean, it is a depressant, right? So when those times happened, I had times even as an adult where I was getting blackout drunk, couldn't remember the night before. And it's not a good feeling to wake up to. And when you get to a point where you're just constantly in a position where you're like, I have to apologize for things I don't even remember doing, you don't feel good about yourself. And it doesn't matter if that happens once or 100 times. Like for me, it just got to a point where enough was enough. And even if it happened just once, I didn't want to be that person in anyone's life anymore. And I didn't want to be that person for myself either. So there's a long, long story around what led to my recovery. There's a lot of pivotal moments that sort of turned that page for me. I feel like that conversation we could be here all night with, to be honest with you.
We'll see. You know what? We'll table that. We'll save that for another.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's so much that goes into it, and even just like certain people in my life that, because that's the thing, right? We don't take accountability and responsibility often for our own shit. Like we just don't. And there were certain people in my life that came into play that they were just really real with me. And that's exactly what I needed. I needed somebody to tell me, look at me and say, you need to get help. Because everybody else in my life, like I said, if they didn't see that side of me, if they only saw the happy, fun version of me, they're like, what do you mean? Like, you're just a social person. Like you just like to have a couple drinks, and like that could be the case. But like I said, it was a coin flip towards the end.
That's good that you actually had, you know, friends or family or friends that were, you know, that kept it real with you. Because what I usually see is people, enablers, they add to it.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, you know what? I used to be one. I mean, in some ways I still am, because the patterns, they don't go away easily. You have to kind of catch them as they're happening and choose your words carefully, because language does matter a lot. Like you can easily say something where you think you're being supportive, but in reality, you're being controlling and manipulative because you want a certain outcome for that person, especially when it's somebody that you truly care about. Like think about the dynamic of a parent who has a child that's abusing drugs or alcohol. Obviously, like they want to protect their child. They want their child to be safe, and they're going to do everything in their power to make that happen. But sometimes it's like with the parent-child dynamic, it gets very complicated because one, most kids don't want to listen to their parents as it is, right? So if your parent's trying to be supportive, they can easily be enabling certain behaviors by, you know, allowing their children to steal and do things to the family that is harmful or hurtful and act out aggressively. And they just keep taking that kid back in because obviously it's their kid, right? When in reality, they need a deeper level of help that the parent themselves probably can't provide. And it's different with every single family, but I just know from personal experience, because I started using at a very young age, there's not much my parents really could have done. And to be honest with you, anything they would have tried to do probably would have just created a situation where they were enabling me even more.
That's real right there. It's definitely real, because I definitely come from, you know, a family to where, you know, I had brothers who were, you know, alcoholics and addicts. And, you know, I had one brother, I was seeing it firsthand, and I would always say to my mom, like, yo, you're enabling him. He's not going to get any better. And her response was, you know, what am I supposed to do? He's my son.
Exactly. Yep. And that's,
and I'm like, go ahead.
It's just a hard situation for a parent to be in. So I get it. Like I get both sides of it. It's just, it's not helpful. And it's hard for the parent to see that because it's their child and they want to protect them.
Very true. And you know, and I remember saying that to her, and I was like, listen, Ma, I know you're trying to protect him and all that. I go, but how are you doing that when you keep giving him money and you know what he's
gonna do,
he's
with
doing
it.
With that.
Yeah, it's a perfect example.
Yep, you know what he's doing with that money. Then when it runs out, he comes back, and then you just keep giving it to him. Like, you're not helping him. How about you know, you give him an ultimatum and tell him go get help. And you know, it was just, and you know, I didn't fully understand it myself. So whenever he would come to the house, him and I would you know, fist fight him. But that was just me acting out, you know, anger, because I felt like he, you know, he kind of, you know, broke some of the family up with his alcoholism, you know. And when I should have been more supportive in a different way, like just like you said, the language, you know, how you speak to somebody, or you know, how you say it, instead of me like, yo, you're a piece of this and that, you're an alcoholic, I should have been trying to, you know, help him.
And I always go back to, you know what, you can't cry over spilled milk. Like, the should have's, they don't help anybody now. And the reality is, like, you did the best you could with what you knew at the time. And going back to the whole language of it, you're absolutely right. It comes down to intentionality. You know, like, what outcome are we going to get from just criticizing somebody and being harsh with somebody, when it's just like, most of the time, especially in addicts, they're just going to get defensive. You know, they're, it's already hard enough for them to receive a message that they need help. So when it comes across in a way that's negative or derogatory, they're just going to get, they're going to put the defenses up. And it just causes a situation where, like, now you're just talking at each other and we're not really coming to any sort of resolution. But you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, at some point, and these situations, as hard as it may be, some sort of ultimatum does need to happen. It's like, if you don't get into a recovery or rehab program, your stuff's going to be on the curb. And I don't want to be in this position. I don't want to have to do that, but it's the only way for you to get the help that you need. And, you know, and you could even say, like, I'll support you with getting that help. You know, I have no problem doing that, but the way things are right now are not working for anybody.
So I know you said there was a lot that went into it, you know, your recovery. So without going into that, what was like one turning moment, would you say, like, you were like, hey, I need to get help?
So the biggest turning moment, well, there was two, really. One was, I got a DUI when I was around 33, so about 5 years ago now. And that DUI shifted everything, because in one moment, and this is the crazy part, I remember getting it and thinking, like, why me at first? And then I was like, why not me? You've been drinking and driving since you were 16 years old. Here you are at 33. Like, how did you escape it this long was the bigger question. So that moment was actually a blessing in disguise, because up until that point, I was still kind of having those occasions where I would wake up blackout drunk, not remember the night. And again, this is as an adult. And so what people don't take into account is, like, there's so much physical toll that it's doing to your body, number one. And you know me as a trainer, like, I could talk about that all day. Like, that's a separate conversation. But alcohol is, in fact, poisonous. It's not doing anything good for you. It's not providing your body with anything. But aside from the physical toll, it's the emotional, mental toll as well. Because how often do you hear people describe a hangover and the next day they don't have the capacity or ability to really show up for life and do anything they wanted to do, right? And then they're beating themselves up about it. And you have so many people that will say, I'll never do this again. But then we forget what it feels like and we do it again. Well, the night of my DUI, I could never forget what that felt like, because when I got arrested, obviously. And I remember being there thinking, like, I don't even know who to call. Like, I literally don't even know who to call, because at that point I was just so embarrassed. I didn't want anybody to know about it. I didn't want to talk to anybody about it. But I also hadn't drank that much. So that was the interesting part of the whole thing. And that's why at first I was like, why me? Like, especially of all nights, it was like 8 o'clock at night on a Wednesday night. I had 1.5 martinis. I'm like, there's nights where I've had 5 or 6 martinis. Like, that's how much I could drink and just get behind the wheel. Like, it was no big thing. And I trust me, I have no place being behind the wheel at all with that amount of intoxication. But the night was expensive, to say the least. I had to spend $10,000 on a lawyer. I had to spend money to get my license reinstated. I lost my license for, oh gosh, it was like, I want to say a little over a year. I did get the temporary license, but it still completely inconvenient because you only have it for specific hours during the day. And even then, and I was required to go to drug and alcohol courses for 16 weeks, an hour and a half every single week. I had to log everything I was drinking because that was my point. I was still drinking despite that. But I felt like, oh, it's okay because I'm Ubering it now. So it's fine. Like, you're doing the responsible thing. That wasn't even really the breaking point because I was still drinking. I thought I could manage my drinking. And that's what most alcoholics think is like, oh, I can manage this now. I have a toolbox that's going to teach me my limits and I'm good. So there was just one day. It was just a regular day like any other day. And I was home and I just felt one of my rules around drinking. And that's a big red flag right there, right? If you have to have rules around your drinking, you probably have some problematic drinking going on. But one of my rules was like, you don't drink alone. What's the point of drinking alone? There's really no need for it. But I had a day where I was just feeling very anxious. That anxiety slowly kind of morphed into sadness and anger. And I was just like running the whole emotional spectrum. So I did everything I knew to do. Like, I meditated, I went for a long walk. I called a couple of my girlfriends just to kind of talk it over. Everything I knew to do to kind of like just relax and get to that space of calm again. And I couldn't. So I came home that day and I'm in my bed and I have a bottle of whiskey on my nightstand and I took a shot of it and I started to feel a little calmer. Then I took another shot and then I took another shot and another shot. And before I knew it, the next day, that night, actually, I woke up in the hospital, didn't remember how I got there, didn't remember anything. And so when I came home the next day, and after like my alcohol levels came down, they just released me from the hospital, didn't have money, didn't have a phone, didn't have anything with me. So I just asked somebody to borrow a phone to call a friend for a ride. Luckily, somebody answered because it was late at night. And I remember just crying on the ride home. And my friend was like, why are you crying? I'm like, I don't even remember how I got here. Like, I don't even remember how I got here. And it just made me so sad. Like, the sadness was just like coming out. And when I got home and I found out through friends what had happened, they were like, you lost it. Like, you got angry at everybody. At one point, you were talking about like wanting to just fight people and hurt people. And like, they're like, we've never, ever seen the side of you. So all of my anger came to the surface. And everything that I was suppressing before I had started drinking all came to the surface when I was drunk. And that's what happened, right? Because everything we're masking and suppressing is going to come out one way or another. I tried to fight and hurt one of my best friends that night. Don't remember doing it. And so as I'm, you know, being told the situation, I'm just crying. And I'm like, that was the moment that I was like, I need to get help. I'm like, I can't live like this anymore. It's just not healthy for anybody. It's not healthy for me. It's not healthy for my friends, any of my relationships. We all deserve better, including me.
That's that's dope, though, that, you know, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, it's, you know, people call it rock bottom. You can call it whatever you want. It doesn't really matter. I think we all have these moments that tell us that something needs to change, something needs to shift, and you have to really, really feel into it. And then once you know it's what you need, then you just have to commit. That's it. It's commitment over anything else.
How long you've been in recovery for?
So it's been 3 years and approximately 3 months. And it truly is one day at a time, as any recovering addict will tell you. And I think the reason that's true is because you don't know when you're going to get triggered, why you're going to get triggered, and how that's going to surface. I do know the difference now is probably, I would say, about a year into my recovery, there were still moments where I felt like I wanted to drink because I missed just certain occasions with friends, like girlfriends, going away on vacation, being able to have a glass of wine, like those type of things were just, I missed moments. But then we get caught up in, you know, the inertia of the past. And now it's like, when I feel any certain type of way, I just don't have the desire to drink because I know what comes with it. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it's almost kind of repulsive to me now. I don't have any issues or judgment around anyone else drinking. I think it's a personal choice. But for me, I just know it doesn't have any space in my life at this point.
That's good. That's real good. Because a lot of the times when hold on. Do you think it's a struggle before I say this? Is it a struggle for you? Is it hard?
Not anymore. It's definitely not a struggle not to drink anymore. And I know not everybody's in that space. I do wish and hope that everybody comes to that space for those that are in recovery, because there is so much life to be had on the other side of it when you're able to just kind of trust yourself again and you're able to love yourself deeper and you're able to just make choices that are congruent with like the person you want to be and how you want to show up. And I will say this, one of the biggest things that I've got from it is just better relationships all around. Much more solid, just heartfelt relationships that I value more than anything. And it's just, they've been so supportive, and it's really truly a community of people that I love and trust and respect more than I ever had. And I know the sentiment's the same. So that's probably one of the most amazing gifts I've got from my recovery.
Good. Congrats on that. Big time. You know what I wanted to. So, well, first and foremost, I think it was just last year I found that out. I think it was something that you had posted on your Facebook. I think it was basically you saying, I'm in my second year of recovery or something like that. And I'm like, what?
Let me see what she's talking about. And then I'm like, wow, I never knew this. I never would have guessed that about you, first and foremost. You know what I mean? Because you also, people who are listening need to, realize I've known Sheena since she was in grade school. You know what I mean? We were in Harbor Cove. You know what I'm saying? So I never would have guessed that about you, but glad that you're doing. I mean, you're doing fantastic, which leads me to the other thing. You're a fitness competitor and a personal trainer. How did you get into that?
So I actually, before all of that, I think it's important to note that I was in corporate accounting and I did not have any passion for it whatsoever. So I can definitely relate to anyone in that world and how people that aren't in the world don't understand how emotionally, mentally draining it can be and how stressful it can be, because the energy in these businesses, and not all of them, so I don't want to say 100% of them because I don't want to put all corporations into a box by any means, but it's like the equation is backwards. It's profits over people versus people over profits. And I say it all the time, like you can't establish a solid foundation where people are happy and want to show up for work and want to put in the effort if that's the equation, right? Like you can't. And my work-life balance wasn't there. I was working crazy, crazy hours every week. Like some weeks were like 80 hours a week, eating crap, like eating a lot of fast food, sitting at a desk all day. My mind would just be totally drained to the point that when you get home, you want to do something where you're just completely vegging out. Like you don't want to give back to yourself. Like you just want to sit there and, watch trashy TV. And not to say I never do that, but the extent to which I did that, it's like I had no life beyond just work and then check out, because that's the world it creates. That's the environment it creates. So towards the end of my accounting days, I remember going to my boss and I was just like, hey, I can't do this anymore. I'm like, this world, I was like, you're the best boss I've ever had. Like literally the best boss I've ever had. This is the best company I've ever worked for in terms of that what work-life balance, but I still have no passion for what I do. So I told him that I asked him first and foremost if I can switch to part-time and the other part of the time I was going to train. And so I did that for a long time. I was doing like 8 to 2 in the office and then going to the YMCA from like 4 to 10 and just at first cleaning equipment, making like minimum wage. And at one point, I had to take the leap I had to just make a decision because I'm like, do I really want this? And I did, because I always loved to train myself. You know, I got out of the habit being in the corporate world, but from a young age, I had started training. I always had a passion for it. I was always curious about it, had teenage fitness books when I was younger. So he agreed to let me go part-time. And that was the catalyst that led me into personal training, because about 6 months of doing the hybrid, I was like, all right, you need to make a choice. And so I dove in headfirst, quit my accounting job for the next year, struggled financially because it was a huge financial hit. And just questioned why I did it, right? Like, I had to keep going back to, well, why did you do this? Because you are passionate about it. And you know that there's a, you know, proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. You know it's coming. You just have to remember that. Remind yourself why you made this choice. And I finally found a small personal training studio that actually did pay really well. And after about a year in, started kind of turning the corner a little bit and getting my finances back in order. And just fell in love with personal training, fell in love with the bodybuilding world, found so much, you know, strength and in the relationships you build in that community. And it was crazy, because there was one point that I did try to kind of go back into accounting a little bit, because I was like, you know, maybe I could do both. Maybe I could do both. And that was 100% fear driven, because I was like, what if I'm not good at this? What if I start losing clients? What if, what if, what if? So I kept playing the what if game. And I was like, no, you don't like this. It literally sucks your life force out of you by doing this type of work. And so since then, like, I truly just haven't looked back. I know it's what I'm meant to do, but also more so, it's morphing more into more. You know, I have a coaching practice now that I never thought was it going to even be a thing as a result of my personal training business, right? So it comes down to, people know they need to eat a little bit better. They know they need to move a little bit more. They're not doing it. Why? Because some of them have jobs like I described. And so it's helping and guiding people to connect and tune in deeper to the reasons behind, like, why am I not prioritizing myself in this way? How can I change the structure of my life to prioritize this? And it looks different for everybody. But that has now kind of morphed into more of a coaching business. I coach people on habit change, nutritional changes, relationship issues, because oftentimes it does stem from a deeper relationship issue with ourselves. We're not valuing ourselves enough. We're not thinking we're deserving or worth it.
You hit the nail on the head with that one. So how did you get into the fitness? Because you're not bodybuilding.
The bikini fitness shows?
Yeah.
So the bikini shows, it's funny. I love when people ask me this question, because my teenage self is like, yo, you are a badass chick now. Like, you have morphed into a beautiful woman that's just so well-rounded. And I feel like I have so much more depth, and that just comes with age and maturity and life experience, right? That's how you gain your wisdom, is through life experience. But backtracking to when I was 15, which is when I actually did start strength training. I started strength training because I had issues around my eating. I had disordered eating. I was anorexic for a while. And then when I realized anorexia was extremely difficult to hide, because people were like, well, why don't you eat? I switched to bulimia. And bulimia was easier to hide because you're still eating, right? And I used to come home from school, binge eat everything in my kitchen, like everything possible. And then I throw up. And nobody knew about this for a long, long, like nobody knew about this until I was an adult. So my parents didn't know. My siblings didn't know. I hid it very well. But it got to a point where I would eat so much that I had to throw up. Like, I no longer had to try to throw up. I had to throw up. And so there was a day I was in the bathroom, and I remember, like, it being painful. Like, my throat was sore. My stomach hurt. And when I looked in the mirror, my eyes were so watery. My face just looked a mess. Like, I looked at myself and I didn't even recognize who I was anymore. And
that's how much you ate?
It was more like, well, the thing is with bulimia, and this is where there's so many misconceptions even around disordered eating, you don't really, you kind of really don't gain or lose weight. You kind of stay the same for the most part, because when you're eating a lot, you're still consuming some of those calories no matter what. But then when you're throwing it up, you're not really consuming all of those calories because you're not allowing the body to process them and break them down and use them as it naturally would, right? So it's more about you don't recognize yourself because of what you're doing to yourself. Like, how did I get here? How did I become this? How am I this insecure? And it's like the insecurity builds. And this is the other part, that children can be very hurtful. And unless they have an outlet to feel safe, that they can talk about it with somebody and process what they're feeling or what they're going through, they hold it in and they just keep it with them. And so I didn't feel like I had anybody in my life to be that person, not even my parents. So for me, it was like I went through that awkward kind of chubby phase in middle school. And I remember, like, you know this, like, I grew up in a predominantly what? Spanish community.
Yep.
You know, so they would say things like, keep walking, fat girl. But I understood what they meant. So little comments like that, it stuck with me like glue, like mentally, emotionally. So I would beat myself up about it. I'd be like, I need to lose weight. I need to lose weight. I need to lose weight. And so that's what led me really to the anorexia. It was like, I need to lose weight. Otherwise, guys aren't going to like me. You know, people are going to look at me like I'm just this gross fat girl. And then, of course, you go through comparing yourself to the other skinny girls that don't like, my body was developed pretty young. So that was kind of weird for me too, because I'm like comparing myself to my friends who are still like not developed yet. But like now that I know better, like looking back at it, none of it would have mattered knowing what I know now, but I had to go through the experience to get where I am now, right? Because all of that led me to, I asked my mom, I was like, I want a gym membership because I wanted to get healthy the right way. And so she was like, okay, on two conditions, like you get yourself there. You know, I was old enough to walk there, and you find a way to pay for it. You know, you could do some chores around the house to try to get some money to pay for it, but you're going to pay for it. You're going to work for it. And I was like, okay. So then my lifestyle became, I would leave school. I would come home and just get a snack, what I thought was healthy at the time, just a little snack. And then I would walk to Gold's Gym in Everett, and I had no clue what I was doing. Like, I was a little kid. Like, I had no clue what I was doing. So I would just people watch and mimic people. And then my next request was when I started asking for teenage fitness books, because I wanted to develop like a deeper understanding for like exercise programming and like why we do certain things. And so I would just jam out like to NSYNC in my bedroom and use this teenage fitness book to learn different exercises, like no joke. And it was like, you know, the all the love songs and just learning to like love myself and connecting with my body even at a young age. But I still suffered from body dysmorphia, because even later on in life, when I gained weight through my corporate accounting job, my first thing that I joined was Weight Watchers at the time. And I think I started Weight Watchers, and I'm only 5'2", so I'm a pretty small person. But I think when I was in Weight Watchers, I may have started around like 160 pounds, give or take. So for me, that felt really heavy. And I remember my goal at the time being like 135 or something like that, which is actually reasonable for my height. But I hit 135 and it wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. I was like, I need more. So then it became like 125, and then it became 120, and then it became whatever it became. I got down to like 97, 98 pounds. And everybody in my office, everybody was like, you're not healthy. Like, you have no weight. You need to stop losing weight. Like, if anything, you need to gain weight at this point. And I would literally pull at my skin, Jeff, like pull my skin away from my rib cage. And I'd be like, no, look at all this fat. And they would look at me like, you're crazy. That's skin. You have no fat left on your body, which everybody always has some fat. You need fat to live. But I was at a point where I had no more fat to lose, is the point. And so I really just started working on my relationship with self in conjunction with my strength training. And that's why nowadays I have more of a holistic approach, because women especially, they don't realize how much their body weight can fluctuate for so many different reasons, menstruation being a huge one. Like, your body weight can fluctuate 5 to 10 pounds during menstruation, but it's like your stress levels will do it. Any inflammation will do it. When you initially start working out, that causes exercise-induced inflammation. So when people don't see an immediate drop in the scale, a lot of times that's why. And then they kind of freak out, like, I'm putting in all this work and nothing's happening. It's like, nope, this is part of the process. Excess sodium in the diet, right? So there's so many other factors that you have to account for, you know, regular bowel movements. And so, like, I'm literally having these conversations with my clients now to be like, no, like, where you're at is exactly where you need to be at. And I understand the mental struggle around weight, but you have to understand as well, like, as a society, we condition people like this. Either they were bullied and they feel like they need to look different, be different, or even when we go to the doctors, anybody that's overweight, that's the first thing they say is like, you need to lose weight. You know, they're not giving you, they're not saying like, hey, you need to get healthier, right? Here's ways to do it. It's like, you need to lose weight. Now just go do it. So it's constantly being reiterated and reinforced that you're too big, you need to lose weight, it's hard to find clothes that fit you, and it creates this sort of like cyclical issue within the person's mindset, right? Because they're like, now they're beating themselves up for not losing weight. And what do people do? They use something as a coping mechanism. Food is one of those things that people can use to cope. So they'll overeat. They'll overeat in excess. And then all of a sudden, okay, now I need to start this new diet. So it's this constant start, stop, and never really making it a lifestyle. And if you make it a lifestyle, then you could be consistent with it versus like the constant seesaw or the constant roller coaster.
So now the whole bikini competitions, that's a lifestyle. Am I correct? Because...
Oh my gosh, I never even answered your question. See how much I could go off on a tangent? So my 15-year-old self, to backtrack a little bit, I had body dysmorphia, so I would never wear a bikini, not even in front of my friends. I always had a t-shirt over it, and they used to make fun of me. They're like, dude, you're fine. Like, you could take your shirt off. And I'm like, no. So I wouldn't take a shirt off in front of anybody. Like, even when I had boyfriends, like way back when, that I was like having sex with, I would not take my shirt off. I was so insecure. So they would say the same thing to me. They're like, you could take your shirt off. It's good. Like, it's fine. And I'm like, nope. Mm-mm. And so the bikini show was my moment to be like, you know what? If I could stand on a stage in front of hundreds of people that I don't know in a bikini with barely any clothing covering my body, I could do anything. I could do anything. That was my, if you could do this, you can do anything moment. And so that's what led me into the shows. What keeps me in them is the camaraderie of the sport, the constant growth, the constant progression, you know, getting to meet so many different people in the industry, getting to network with people that are like my inspiration in the industry, and just taking my fitness to other levels in so many different ways, because they allow me to grow personally, but they also allow me to grow professionally by meeting so many different people.
Now, because I had been, you know, in the past many times, people, you know, like other guys, like, oh, you should get into bodybuilding, you should start doing competitions. And I'm like, yo, that's a 24/7 lifestyle. Like, I would literally watch other guys who, you know, were in competition mode, and they were, you know, besides watching what they eat, their salt intake, their sodium intake, their hydration intake, I would see them literally weigh like grains of oats and and almonds, like put it on a little scale, like, okay, there you go, put it in their hands and eat it. And I'm like, what the hell? And I'm like, well, yo, I can't do it.
Well, this is the truth of it. Everybody has different levels of how serious they want to take it. Like, do I think that I'm eventually going to be a pro, like working the pro stage? Because up until this point, I've been doing just amateur competitions. Maybe not. But the reality is, like, during, so when you're not in show prep mode, it's called your off season. Most people in off season go into a build mode. Now, some people are very, very, very strict during their build mode, even, because they're like, the more I'm doing this around the clock, the better I'm going to come in, you know, when it is time to peak and when it is time to get into the cut phases. And it's true. They're basically going to be well positioned to come in with a more, you know, leaner physique, if that's their goal, once they hit that stage. For me, when I'm in off season, I'm not as strict. Like, I don't measure during off season. I just try to keep my choices whole, like eat mostly whole foods, keep my protein numbers up, keep my hydration up. So I have certain things that I stay consistent with, but those are all more habits. And that's what I tell anybody, whether you're a bodybuilder or not, you got to find what your baseline is. So I go back to my baseline when I'm in sort of my build mode. I'll eat more carbs because that's kind of the goal, is to put on a little bit more muscle when you're off season. And then when it's time to cut and I'm actually doing a show, then it does change to everything you just said, like monitoring how much water intake I'm getting, weighing and measuring all of my foods, you know, consistently hitting my macros, consistently timing my meals, consistently getting in my workouts. But just like anything, you become so used to it that it doesn't feel as challenging or difficult as it used to. Like my first show, it felt like a lot. I was like, how the fuck do people keep up with this stuff? Like, how do they do it? I don't even know. But then my second show was like a little bit more manageable. And then by the time I got into my third show, I was like, oh, this is no big deal, because I know what to expect. You know, I know how to prepare for it physically and mentally. I know how to manage my time accordingly. So I'm spending time on meal prep and weighing everything out and measuring. And everybody's always at different places when they're prepping too. I'm like, you know what? If you know your life's going to be a little bit busier with work or kids or whatever else you got going on, hire a meal prep service. Like, hire somebody that's going to help you with the process so you're not overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, true. So now it's like, it's second nature to you?
It's definitely more second nature now. And I definitely don't take it as seriously as some people, which makes me probably less competitive than I could be. And, you know, that's something I get to reevaluate and change if I want to. Like, do you want to go pro status? Because I know I'm capable of it. And part of it is just like you said, it's more of a time commitment. So it's evaluating, like, what is important to me in my life right now? And I look at it as just finding balance in your life and understanding, like, your time is your most valuable asset, hands down. And I think the more people connect to that, the more you get to be more conscious and aware of how you're spending your time. You know, I often, when I do a consult, it's kind of the same thing, the same point I get people to. It's like, okay, I want to lose weight, I want to get healthier, yet they're making no time to prioritize it at all in the beginning. And that's not 100% of people, but I work with general population a lot. So most of Gen Pop, it's like, okay, you know, I'm working a full-time job because most families do need the dual income. So they're working full-time. In a lot of situations, they do have, you know, a couple kids, in some cases three, who have different schools, different curricular activities. And then, like, they're trying to spend time with their significant other. Like, some couples are like, we don't have time together. Like, our time is like when the kids are finally off to bed, and it's like we have a little bit of time, right? So my role in people's life is to help them find the windows of opportunity. And if they truly don't have any of that, recognizing that something has to give. There's too much on your plate and something has to give. You have to take something off your plate in order to make this a priority. And that's where the delegation comes in. Where can you ask for help in certain areas that you're not currently getting if you need it? Even if you want to eat a little bit healthier, like I said, hire a meal prep service, at least for a while, so you get a better understanding of what eating healthier looks and feels like. And then you could start replicating some of those things on your own. But my meal prep methodology with most of my clients, given the nature of where they're at, it's all about convenience. Like, overnight oats, it's not hard. It takes 30 seconds to make it. Is it the most healthy option for a weight loss client if we're looking at global health? It's not the most healthy. Is it 100 times better than what most people are doing in the morning? Absolutely. And it takes you 30 seconds to make it. So when people kind of use excuses like, I don't have time, well, yeah, you don't have a lot of time, but you can still make better choices. You can absolutely still make better choices. And the example I always give people is, how long does it take you in the morning to sit in a Dunkin' Donuts drive-thru and get a donut, right? Or whatever it is they're getting.
True.
Option one, it's like, okay, first and foremost, switch your donut to an egg sandwich. You're at least going to get a little bit of protein in, and it's going to be better than the donut for sure. It's not going to have as much sugar, right? But then when they evaluate how much time they're spending, how much it's upcharging the cost, how quick is it to put an egg in a pan and scramble it up while you're toasting some bread? Like, it's not that, it doesn't take that long. You're just not doing it. So it's getting them to recognize that a lot of the justifications, there's a solution for, you're just not doing it. So how do we change your mindset around that and switch gears a little bit? Because even just having a protein shake with some greens in it in the morning can be a meal in itself, and it doesn't take a lot of time to do that.
Yeah, I never, whenever I hear people, so, you know, when it comes to the gym, I mean, because I was a personal trainer for 10 years, but I got burnt out from that. So I gave it up. Whenever they say, I don't have the time, I don't have the time to work out, I don't have the time to do this, I don't have the time to do that. And, you know, I'm just shaking my head. Like, so you're just looking for an excuse, you know, to not have to do it. Because these are the same people who have the time to either go to a bar, go to a club, you know, go hang out with friends at these bars or clubs, or you know, go out to eat at a restaurant, you know, all the time. And I'm like, 45 minutes? You don't have 45 minutes to give to be healthy? You know, that's crazy.
I think it's also just bringing people back to a certain level of awareness that everything in life we do or don't do, it's a choice. And we just have to become more conscious of what those choices are. Because to your point, one of the other reasons I get when people are like, oh, I can't work with you is I can't afford you. And I think it's always interesting because so many of my clients that end up working with me end up saving money because the very habits that they need to change, which is going out a lot, right? Going out to eat a lot, going out to drink a lot. It's like they need to spend more time doing a little bit of prep, making more foods at home to the extent possible so they know what's going into those foods. So oftentimes I end up, all said and done, actually saving people money because their going out budget is so crazy and they don't even realize it. They're not aware of it. And it's like, even if you're only going out once a week, how often do we go out once a week, easily drop $100 on dinner drinks? And that's being conservative. Oftentimes, if there's two of you, it's going to be a little bit more. Well, boom, $100 a week times four. If you're doing this every week, there's 400 a month right there. Right there, there's 400 a month. And how often are people doing it more than once a week? And then you add in the morning coffee. Then you add in the occasional lunch out. Maybe you're eating lunch out 2 to 3 times a week. Think about how quickly this adds up. You know, we're already up to what, like $1,000 a month and just a going out budget. So yeah, you can afford it. You just have to be consciously aware that the choices you're currently making are not aligned with the goals that you say you want. And so I bring people back to that level of awareness and say, like, look, I'm here to meet you in the middle. It's not about not having fun. It's not about not having a social life. It's about making the choices that you actually want to make and recognizing that it could be like, okay, when do I want to go out? How often do I want to go out? Who do I want to prioritize going out with? Because what I said earlier stands true here. Time is your biggest asset. So how you're using that is going to shape your life.
So true. Now, my next question for you is, what's your relationship status? What's your dating life like?
Oh gosh, he went there. Okay, so I am single. I'm definitely single. This is the hard part about and we kind of touched upon this, and this was kind of led to this podcast today, dating in 2022. Because of everything I just said and all of the commitments that people our age already have in their lives, it's hard to want to make time and space for somebody new. So I'm going to start with this. I am not the type of person, and I have figured this out about myself, I cannot date multiple people at once. It does not work for me. It's never going to work for me. And there's a couple of reasons for this. Who I give my time and energy to, I'm extremely selective about. I want to know that there's potential for it to go somewhere. That doesn't mean I need to know right in that moment that, you know, we're going to be life partners forever, because time tells the full story. And that's kind of my motto there, is like, you got to get to know somebody. You got to get to know if what you value in life and what is meaningful to you and how you want to spend your time is aligned. Because if it's not, then you're not going to be able to grow together. So that's number one. In terms of dating, right now, I'm not really dating anybody. I was talking to somebody for a while, and to be honest with you, it's really like where we're both at in our lives. Neither one of us was making it a priority. And what the dynamic between this man and I taught me about myself was that if I truly want to have that person, that life partner in my life, I have to create more space in my life for it. You know, I am the classic workaholic. I work so much. And so even trying to prioritize spending time together becomes problematic. And especially if I'm meeting a man who is kind of doing the same thing, right? Somebody that works a lot, really values their career, has a full life. And so that's sort of where I'm at, is finding it difficult to meet somebody where it's like, you know what? I want to change and create space in my life. But I realized I was wrong in that thinking. I have to create the space first in order to allow someone to enter my life.
Yep. Yep. Very true. Or else it's just going to end up, every man you come across that you decide to talk to a date, it's just going to, it's just setting yourself up for failure.
Yep. And I think it's also learning to be very, and, you know, I coach women in relationships. I coach men as well. It's so hard for so many of us to be vulnerable. It's so hard for us to be authentic with what we truly want and what we, who, like, what we're truly looking for, because of some level of fear that if we're honest about it, we're going to quote unquote scare the person away. And I'm like, you know what? It's better to scare people away, because if you're honest and they're not willing to, if they're not in a place rather to see where you're at and they're ready to receive that type of relationship, then you kind of want to scare them away. You know, like, why are we going to go into something completely on different pages? Like, and this is the problem I have with friends with benefit situations. And I've had these conversations mostly with women, because let's face facts. Women get more attached when they have sex with a man. It's just how it works. Like, we, oxytocin is produced and we get a much bigger high from the experience. And because of that, we get attached to the man. And what happens to us on a physiological level, I'm more aware of it. So I know, because I'm more aware of it, I can almost anticipate, like, okay, this is how I'm going to feel about a man if I have sex with him. And so I have to be real with women when I have these conversations. And I'm like, look, you think you can have a friends with benefits situation, but in reality, two things happen. You're closing yourself off from having a deeper relationship and a deeper level of connectedness. I can't have sex with somebody unless I have that deeper connectedness first. If that part isn't there, I just wouldn't be attracted to the man. But what a lot of women don't realize is if they think that they could just have sex, it's not really true. At some point, and you can call it whatever you want, you can call it catching feelings, like you're connected to them because you're exchanging energy at the deepest human level possible, right? And so with all that being said, I'm at a place in my life where I can no longer compromise my values to get my needs met. And there was a time in my life where that wasn't true. There was time in my life, like one of my best guy friends and I, this was like several years ago, we both happened to be single at the same time. This is like first time I ever tried this type of situation. We're both like, hey, do you want to just hook up and kind of see how this goes? And so I agreed to it. And I was like, I'll agree to it on one condition, that if the other person at any point decides that the situation isn't working, we're going to be 100% honest with each other and there's going to be no hard feelings about it. And we're just going to continue being friends and what have you. And of course it was me, right? Like it went on for a few months and I was like, this doesn't work for me. And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, I need more from a person. Like I can't give my body to a man and not feel a completely disconnection with myself for it just being that. I'm like, because I am starting to care about you. I am starting to develop deeper feelings for you. And I kind of knew this would happen. It was kind of giving myself the benefit of the doubt. You can call it a test. You can call it whatever you want, but it doesn't work for me. So the reason I mentioned that is I think for any person, it's truly understanding at a deep level, like what your own personal values are, and then learning how to communicate that even when it's scary, because often it will be, because we're often afraid, again, we're going to scare the person away. But if you do, that person's not meant for you anyway, and you're just saving each other time. Like that's all you're doing, is you're saving each other time. Because I don't think, my personal take after working with men and women, most people aren't truly afraid of commitment. They're either not in a place in their life where they want it, right? Or they're just afraid to commit to the quote unquote wrong person who doesn't share the same values as them. Well, the only way you're going to know that is if you're able to have authentic, vulnerable conversations and express who you truly are.
I'm glad you, you know, you just said that, is because we are now in a, this day and age is terrible, but we are now in a day and age that I've realized that people just give up. They, instead of sticking it out and, you know, like, you know, fighting, or, you know, trying to, you know, make it work. And what I mean by giving up, I mean, like, you know, you could be dating, you know, someone, a man, and you find out something about him, not, you know, not anything serious, like, you know, he has a wife or a girlfriend. I don't mean like that. I mean something that you may find like that gets on my nerves. And it just quick to just say, yeah, this ain't gonna work. This ain't gonna work between us. I just noticed that people are just quick to just hit the eject button then rather, like, you know, like, yo, stick it out, make it work. We're not saying to, you know, what was it that you said? Compromise your what?
Compromise your values to get your needs met.
Exactly.
And so, like, for just to give you an example, this would be how I'd be compromising one of my values to get my needs met. Having sex with a man that I'm not in a committed relationship to. I have sexual needs. I want to get them met, but I'm not committed to him. Therefore, like, would it be appropriate for me to be like, oh, I want you to only sleep with me and I want to see where this goes? No, like, we're not in a committed relationship. And I mean, that's part of being committed. It's not the only part, but it is one part. But I think it's fair to be like, to say, like, even on other levels and layers to it, the problem most people have is not even knowing what their own values are. Because going back to that initial post that I put out there, you know, women having a checklist. This is a perfect example. Most of their checklists, and I'm sure you've seen it and heard it and you've come across this, and I'm not saying men don't do this too. Women are probably more vocal about it for sure. But they'll be like, oh, he has to be 6 feet or taller. He has to make $150,000 a year or more. He has to drive this type of car. He has to, but like, he has to, right? And it's all superficial. It's like, at the end of the day, none of that matters. None of it matters. Like, what do you really value in another person? What's going to make you fall deeper in love with that other person? What's going to create a solid foundation, right? And so for me, it's like trust and and loyalty and reliability? Do you do the things that you say you're going to do? Support, you know, and at the end of the day, like all of it can just be summed up into unconditional love. Like, I love you without any conditions attached. And to find that in another person, you have to be able to communicate what is important to you. And truthfully, like, what do you want out of life? Like, for example, I love to travel. It's one of the things I absolutely love to do. So if I meet a man and he's like, oh, I don't really love to travel. Travel is kind of like one of those things. Like, I don't really want to make a priority. I'm more of a homebody. You know, I like just staying in this area. It's never going to work, right? Because one of the things I love to do, he doesn't. And so I'm not saying you have to love everything, but at some level, the most important things to you, you need to be able to say, like, this is what I need in a relationship. Like, these are my needs. And if the person can't meet your needs, well, then they have an opportunity to say it, but you're not even giving them a chance if you don't express what they are. And when you make it just about the superficial, it's going to be short-lived, because once those deeper needs aren't being met, it's not going to work, right? So to your point about people just kind of like cutting people too soon, I think it's okay if you do that when it's for the right reasons and you realize very early on you're not aligned on the bigger stuff, but it's knowing what those bigger things are and not making it about like, oh, you know, he's 5'11". He's not 6 feet, so it's just never going to work. Or he left his clothes on the floor instead of putting him in the hamper. It's never going to work. Like, whatever. Like, it's the little things, because one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from somebody was, don't argue with your partner or significant other over roommate type of shit. Because at the end of the day, that's little things that truly don't matter. You know, does that person... do you deeply connect with that person on so many other levels that the superficial stuff just doesn't matter? It's not important.
Yeah, for real. Yep, I agree with that. And you know, going back to, you know, what you're saying about, like, you know, the women who are like, oh, he got to be 6 feet or 6'1", whatever, make 150K a year, drive a nice car. What I've noticed is, not all, but a lot of them, most of those men who do drive nice cars, make 150K a year, those are the men who don't value, who don't respect women, who don't value women, because they look at it like, I'm a hot commodity. I'm 6 feet, 6'1". I make 150K a year. I drive a Benz. I have a house. I'm handsome. So this chick, it's nothing. You know what I mean? For every one woman I lose, I 2 or 3 more pop up.
So I'm going to give you a little bit more perspective on that, because I know a lot of men that fit that bill, like personally, and I'm talking men that I've coached, friends of mine fit that bill, even guys I've dated who have been amazing. So not all of them do. Here's the reality of that. Women are only going to be valued to the extent to which they value themselves. And a man like that, obviously, he knows just as well as the women do that he's very sought after, right? And so if he feels in any way, shape, or form that that woman, and I'm not saying any of this is right or wrong, it's the way it works sometimes. If he feels that woman only wants him for those characteristics, that's the way he's going to treat her. Like, we show people how we deserve to be treated based on our own actions. And again, not saying it's right or wrong, but if she's only coming across as superficial and that's all, like, think about this, like, imagine taking a woman on a first date and these are the types of questions she's asking, and she's not asking like, hey, so what do you like to do? What's important to you? How do you spend your day? What's your mission in life? Like, what are you passionate about, right? If you're not getting to know a man on that level, then he's not going to care to get to know you on that level, and he's just going to treat you as more of the same. So there's always two sides to the coin, and that's what I say. Like, there's no group of people that's all inherently good or all inherently bad. I think we all have different characteristics that sometimes can be exploited by the other sex in such a way that it makes the other person feel just as undervalued. Because let's face facts, the dating game has become like commodity. Like it's become a market. Like how often do you hear people say I'm no longer on the market? Like I'm not on the market because I'm not a fucking piece of meat on a shelf.
Like a house.
We're people with so much more depth and so many more layers to us. And I think we've missed the old days of like, this is non-existent now, where there is an actual courtship, where it's like a process where, you know, the man does these nice little gestures and you get to know each other and you get to kind of really bond and connect on all these different levels. And then you get to decide, like, is this person someone I can have a future with? And some of those people, like I said earlier, you're going to know that a lot sooner rather than later. And I'm at the point in my life where I feel into somebody's energy more than anything. And there are men that I've met that I could feel right off the bat. They're just needy. They'll take any woman that says yes, it doesn't matter. And when I feel that from a guy right off the bat, I'm like, it's so unattractive to me because that's just telling me that like, I'm not really that special. You haven't got a chance to know my heart. You haven't got a chance to know who I am. So you're kind of just looking at me like, oh, she's pretty. She has a nice body. Like she somewhat has her shit together. Okay, sure. Like I'll take this one. So to me, it's like, both men and women can do that. Now, if you're reading that type of vibe right off the bat, here's the other side of it. It could be that he's just genuinely excited and interested in you. And you know, it's coming across in a way that feels needy. So it's not like I write everybody off for that. I might give it a few dates. And if that dynamic doesn't start to shift, then I know like this isn't ever going to work. And I'll give you one example of how this has played out. So I went on a couple of dates with a man, you know, both times were dinner. And the second time it was like a Friday night. And then Saturday morning, he messaged me and was like, hey, I had a really great time last night. I was wondering if you wanted to go out to dinner again tonight. And I said to him, I was like, hey, I already have dinner plans, but thank you for the offer. Looking forward to when I see you next. So somewhere along the day that Saturday, he messaged me again. He's like, oh, how about brunch tomorrow? Talking about Sunday. And I was like, hey, I'm really sorry. Like, I already have plans tomorrow. I was like, let's catch up sometime next week. And then he was just like, I get the feeling you just don't want to see me. And like, you know, it just kind of went off on this whole like emotional tangent. And I'm like, I never said that. I actually said I was looking forward to seeing you. I mean, you're kind of changing my mind about that right now because, you know, I already told you I'm a busy person. Like my weekends are usually planned for. Like I had no problem scheduling something for next week, but now I'm kind of getting the vibe. Like I don't really want to because it sounds like you're going to need more of me than I'm able to give right now. And that's how I left it with him. And that's as honest as I possibly can be. You know, I don't slander people. Like I didn't like put his name out there and being like, oh, he's a red flag because he's needy. Why? Because somebody, Jeff, might actually want that level of seeing each other, right? Somebody might actually appreciate that. And for me, that was just too much too quick. So this is what I mean about knowing yourself. Like I knew that about myself early on. And because of that, what did I do? I saved us both time. It's not that he's a bad guy. We're both in different places and it seems like he wants a person that he could spend a lot of time with very quickly. And I'm not there. So I get to be honest about that. But guess what? A guy who's just as busy and has a lot going on in his life is going to respect that and understand it. And we have to find the dynamic that would work for us essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in that, I've been in that situation in the past, you know, with my line of work. And a lot of the times the women just, they couldn't understand, you know, like they could understand it, you know, where it's like, yo, listen, I'm a referee. And they looked at it like, oh, well, you only work an hour a day. Like, no, I do not. I do not work an hour. I do not just work an hour a day. You know what I mean? Like if you actually took the time and asked me questions, you would know that. You're just making an assumption. Sports are 7 days a week from the moment kids get out of school till like 11 at night. You know what I mean? You have, you know, recreational, you know, sports, like, you know, like the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club and all that stuff. So, you know, so they couldn't understand, you know, when I was doing it like you, when I was like, all right, well, you know what? I can't do it this day or this day. You know, how about this day? And then it's like, oh, well, it doesn't look like you're interested. I didn't say that. You know what I mean? Like, if I wasn't interested, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now if I wasn't interested. We wouldn't even be talking. But like you said, I had just learned real quick that is just, you know, women who either, who, you know, who are either needy, like you said, or maybe they come from an environment or from a place to where all the men they dated were available to them 7 days a week, 24/7. And that's what they're used to. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with that. But that's when I say that's, you need to go find that.
100% agreed. And I'll be honest with you, like, I'll be the first to admit there's been men that have come into my life where I've been on the opposite end of the spectrum, where these particular men, successful men, you know, they, but they're, you can tell that they're deeply caring. They're very passionate about what they do. They're passionate about the lives they live. And certain men have brought my insecurities to the surface where I'm like, oh, this guy could never like me. What does he see in me? And so your mind does have a tendency to sort of play tricks on you, because in most situations, I'm extremely confident. I know what I bring to the table in a relationship. I know the person I am. I value myself very highly. I know my worth. And yet every now and then there's a person that comes along that triggers my insecurities. And, you know, in the past I would have like really been hard on myself when that happens. Nowadays it's kind of like, what is this telling me about myself? Where are the areas I need to still do a little bit of self-work? Because if I was completely grounded in this situation and I wasn't being triggered, then it would just tell me like, there's nothing here that needs to be resolved within me. So I think what we can often do is easily put it on the other person. Like, oh, he's just not interested. Like what these women were doing to you. When in reality, it's like, no, like you never said that. Let's look at the facts of the situation. So what is it within you that's causing you to feel insecure in this moment? And how do we address your own insecurity? And how do we work through that versus projecting on this man that has nothing to do with it? He's just bringing it out of you.
I'm glad you know, once again, you talked about insecurity, and you know, you're a coach, you coach women. What do you say to women who are insecure? Because I've dealt with, it seems like the majority of women that I've either dated, was in a relationship with, or come across have all been insecure. Like I've had dated women where, oh, I'm, you know, I don't know what you see in me. I'm fat. I'm not attractive. And I'm just like, yo, yep. why are you even thinking that way? Why? Well, because, you know, I grew up abused. My father said I would never amount to anything. No man would want me. All the men that I had, you know, in the past abused me or called me fat, ugly, said that I'd be nothing without them, you know, that no man would ever want me. And I'm like, okay, first and foremost, you say all these men, right? Every one of these men said you would never, you know, no man would ever want you. Then how the hell did you end up with so many men?
Yep.
You know what I mean? That's first and foremost.
So, you know what
I mean? And the other thing with me is, yo, listen, that is when you were a child. You are now in your 30s and 40s. Get the fuck over it. Why are you even focused on why I'm with you? Like, you know, what do I see in you? We're together. I'm not asking you for anything. Just enjoy it.
Okay.
Why are you trying to sabotage the relationship?
There is so much to be said for what you just said. And first and foremost, it's getting women to recognize their own value. But there's a lot that goes into this process. So I'm kind of glad you brought it up. Number one, women often don't know how to express what they're feeling because they don't even know what they're feeling. I can't even tell. So first, I allow them to tap into their own feeling in order to express it to a man in a way that's actually healthy. Because rather than saying that to you, if you know, a woman that you were dating came to you and was like, hey, you know, when you do X, Y, or Z, it makes me feel really jealous. I know this is probably something I need to work through, but I'm just telling you to let you know this is how I'm feeling, and express it in a way that it's like you're not blaming the person. You're taking accountability for how you're feeling, because your feelings are yours. So you get to identify like where it's coming from. But only to create the only way rather to create awareness around it is to first identify what the feeling is. And this is the funny part. I can't tell you, and this does apply to men too, because I do work a little bit with men, but when I ask a woman, like, how are you feeling today? I feel like shit. Well, that's great, because shit's not a feeling. Like, we can put a lot of other labels on that, but shit is not a feeling. So here we go again, right? How are you feeling today? I'm feeling fat. That's great, but fat's not a feeling. So the first thing I do with women is I get them to actually identify, like, what are you feeling? I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling insecure. I'm feeling lonely. I'm feeling jealous. I'm feeling frustration. I'm feeling mad. I'm feeling angry. And once she can tap into the feeling, she can then start to form the ability to better express it. And what I mean by better is just authentic. Like, this is truly what you're feeling, but you don't even know it because you've bypassed it your whole life, because bypassing was your way to survive. Bypassing was your way to just push through and never actually sit with it, because it's fucking uncomfortable. And I get it, because I've had to sit through a lot of uncomfortable feelings through my sobriety. And I had to sit through the loneliness. I had to sit through the anger. I had to sit through the sadness. And what happens is we start to judge it. So we start to just bypass. And bypass, we could use anything as a distraction. It could be social media. It could be overworking. It could be, oh, you just got your heart broken. Let me go try to find somebody else to date. Not allowing yourself to be single, right? And process what just happened in your past relationship. So first and foremost, helping women to actually tap into what they're feeling in their heart. The second part of that equation is to help them truly learn how to express it in a healthy way without blaming the other person, because that's what we do. We blame our insecurities on the man as if he can fix us. It's like, he can't help you with that, sweetheart. Like, that's your own bag of shit that you're bringing to the table, right? So once they realize, like, where the jealousy is coming from, why they're feeling that way, once they realize where the insecurity is coming from and why they're feeling that way, you start to develop more acceptance around it. And that acceptance allows it to dissolve. It allows you to kind of be freed from it. It's like kind of, you know, without that acknowledgement around it, without that awareness around it, you're never going to be able to accept it as part of you. So you're just going to keep projecting it and projecting it and projecting it and throwing it at other people that you care about, because of you think it's their fault you feel this way. It's not their fault. You came with these feelings. Now we have to unravel them.
Amen. So, man. We will have to split this to like two parts, because I have so many questions. I have so many. So I know two other things that I wanted to bring up, you know, before we, you know, we wrap this up, but we definitely are going to schedule to do a part two to this, is what do you say to, you know, women who, and I say women because I'm a man, so I'm speaking from my
point of view,
experience and point of view, is what I've always run into is women who use my past against me, you know, and which will bring up something else, is women will say they want a man to be honest, tell me the truth, you know, and keep it real. I found the mistake that I make is I'm too honest. And I tell them about, you know, my past. Like, yo, listen. And in the past, I was a big time player. Yeah, you know what I mean? I would sleep around with women, this and that. You tell them that. And I'm like, man, that was when I was in high school. That was in my 20s and in my early 30s. You know, I ain't like that anymore. So then you date them. I date them, get into a relationship with them. Some situation may arise, like, you know, who was that woman? Oh, she's just a friend or whatever. Oh, well, then why is she commenting on your page with the heart emoji? I don't know. You know what I mean? That's what women do. Well, I was like, why don't you believe me? Well, you did say you used to be a player. What does that have to do with me right now?
There's a lot of layers to this again. So first and foremost, a woman can't fully accept your past if she hasn't even come to fully accept her own. So she's going to, again, get to a point where she's now just projecting, right? We're all just always projecting. So there's something that has to do with your past that brings up insecurities that are based on experiences that she's been through. And so it's learning to really separate the past from the present moment. And a big part of all of this is just learning to truly live in the present moment, which a lot of us aren't that great at. We'll literally take the past and project it onto the present all the time. I see it happen in so many different situations. In terms of the too honest, you can never be too honest with a woman who has worked through some of her old stuff, because she's going to respect you for that honesty. Now, with that being said, it sounds like a lot of the women you've dated haven't, right? So that's where the insecurity comes up. But here's the deal. Everything I just said still applies. Let's say, for example, I was commenting on your stuff, but I was doing it at a pace and a level that was like uncomfortable, meaning like it was more flirtatious in nature. And then your current girlfriend brought it up to you, but she brought it up to you in a way it was like, hey, this girl on your page, she's kind of making me feel insecure. You know, is there anything I need to be worried about? And then if you explain to me like, yeah, she kind of is a little bit too much. Maybe I will remove her just out of respect for our relationship. Or if you explain in a way like, hey, there's nothing going on. Like, she's just an old friend, like whatever the case may be. My job as your woman is to accept and trust in your response, because I trust in you as a person. And that foundation of trust is built on our ability to express our truth without the other person putting it back in your face at a later time, right? And the only way you can do that is to learn to have these conversations in a healthy way, rather than saying like, oh, but you used to be a player, so what's going on here? Intentionality always matters. Like, what are you hoping the outcome to be? And if you're hoping to just have an honest, authentic conversation without, again, pointing fingers and blaming the other person for somebody else's actions, even, like, to me, that whole situation nowadays is kind of laughable, because social media, people are commenting and loving each other's stuff all over the place, right? And so there also has to be a talk around these very areas in a relationship dynamic to talk about level of comfort, right? You saw the post I made the other day, or maybe you didn't, about the women that were on social media talking about how they would never allow their men to have Facebook, yet they were posting this on Facebook, right? And so the justifications later in the dialogue were, oh, men are different. They're just on here to flirt. We're on here to build authentic connections. And I'm laughing as I'm reading it, because all everybody ever does is make assumptions about the other person's actions, thoughts, beliefs without ever having a conversation about it. You know, like, if I am having a social media account, my man should be able to have a social media account. If we both mutually decide together that it's not right for us because it just brings up too much of our past stuff and it's too triggering and there's just no need for us to have one, that's a whole different conversation. But it's, again, going to be very specific to the individuals in the couple. It sounds like you've dated women that haven't worked through their old stuff and they continue to just kind of project it on you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, well, yeah, until now. So, now, Sheena, I have so many questions.
I know, I feel like I need to ask you questions to hear things from a male perspective.
We need to, all right, so you know what? We need to do a part two of this, all right? So, you know, because, you know, we'll wrap this one up, and either if you're available later on in the week or whenever, because I'm working off of your schedule. But we need to do a part two of this, because I have other questions I want to write down. You know what I mean? So that way I can just boom, 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 throw them at you and not have to in my mind be, you know what, let me say.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. Even I was going to say, even from that one post, like, there's so many lines in that post that we can drill down on and, you know, talk more openly about, because these are all things that I've seen by being in a lot of these women's groups. And one of the overarching things is like, women just, not all women, again, I'm not putting all women in boxes, because some of them have done the work, continue to do the work. And to be honest with you, there's equally as many men that probably have a lot of work to do around being emotionally expressive, because it's not a thing that most men are comfortable with. It's just a big stigma in society. So that's a whole other conversation. But essentially, one of the biggest things I've seen is women bash men a lot. How are you going to expect a man to want to be with you if all you're doing is bitching and complaining about them?
Seriously.
And so it's crazy to me because I almost want to be like, I want to host a women's group at some point and be like, okay, I'm going to read some things off to you and pretend like they were said by men and see how it makes them feel. And then be like, how does it make you feel that it was actually women who said all this and not men? Because if we were to turn the tables around, some of the stuff I see women say, if a man was talking about us in that way, we would want to burn them at the stake, right? Like,
yeah,
how dare you talk about women like that? Fuck him, right? And they would literally have like a whole gang of women ready to just tear the man down if it was the other way around. So I do see now how women have a lot of double standards. And I am not going to sit here on a pedestal by any means and say that I haven't identified my own double standards. I have identified a lot of them, but I've also worked through them. And I've also been able to be more open in new relationships about them. Like, how do you feel about X, Y, or Z? Because we have to be on the same page with this. And if we're not, that's okay. But it also means that this relationship might not be going anywhere. Because I know from experience from men that I've dated that I didn't, and I'm glad somebody finally said something, because again, I don't know unless you tell me either. And that's the side that I feel like men don't do a great job sometimes. But one of the men I was dating finally said, like, hey, you make me really insecure with all the attention you get. And I was like, thank you for saying that. Like, and it gave me an opportunity to be like, you have nothing to worry about. Like, I am all for you. And that goes back to something I was saying earlier, where this is why I cannot date more than one man at a time, because I put all of my heart and energy into developing a deeper connection with that person. And that's something that I've recently changed, because in the past I would try to date a couple people at the same time. And it's just, one, I didn't have time for it. Two, it would cause a lot of conflicting feelings within me, because then I would start comparing them against each other. And I'm like, it's not about comparison. Like, how does this person make you feel? Like, how do you feel when you're with them? How do you feel when you're not with them? Do you want to, you know, dive deeper into this relationship? Do you want to continue to grow and get to know them? And you can't do that, in my opinion, with multiple people if your ultimate goal is to find a person that you want a partnership with and a long-term life with.
Yep. Yep. Very true. We are... When can we complete this? Do the part two of this? Well, actually, you know what? We're not gonna set that up now, you know, through the podcast.
I'm just excited to get this going.
I'll shoot you a text, but we need to definitely do a part two of this, because like I said, I have so many questions, and you said you have so many questions that you want to ask me. And
yeah, because I know this sounds crazy, but have you heard of the Fresh and Fit podcast?
Fresh and Fit?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. But now that you told me about it, I do love listening to podcasts. So
go check it out, because the thing is with them, they kind of, I don't want to say bash women a lot, but they definitely have very strong views on women. And so my take on their whole podcast is they have a lot of double standards in love and relationships when it comes to men and women. And I think it's because, going back to some of the things you've seen in your relationships and how women can be sometimes, it's like, well, men can be a certain way sometimes too. So I think you and I talking, like, we're really trying to find the middle ground. With Fresh and Fit, they're just kind of like, nope, like, this is what women do. This is why, like, it's okay for men to do what we do. And it just creates a lot of different double standards in relationship dynamics.
And, you know, I'm definitely going to listen to it and then, you know, bring that up in, you know, the next podcast we do. But for as long as men keep doing that, what they're doing, the Fresh and Fit, and women keep doing what they do in that little social media, you know, group on Facebook, what men and women were always going to be at odds. We're always going to be at odds.
Exactly.
We're always going to be enemies.
We're not allowing ourselves to be vulnerable about Well, one, about what we're really going through, but we're not allowing ourselves to be open to hearing the other side and how we're making them feel. Because I think women neglect the fact that men actually do have feelings. They just aren't going to talk about them all the time because that's how men are made in today's present day society. But you have to acknowledge that no, they're human. Like, of course, they have feelings. They manage and process them very differently, but they have them. And so you can't just bash him, slander him, talk down about him to your female friends and have them be okay with that. Because if he was doing that amongst his group of friends, again, you'd want to burn him at the stake. So that's the biggest double standard I see overall is,
Yep.
when I talk to my girlfriends about men, and I've even stuck up for men in my life, and part of it's because they'll be like, oh, a lot of times the advice you'll get from women, and it's not great advice, is like, oh, fuck him, just leave him. Like, he doesn't deserve you. He doesn't deserve you. And I think from the mind of women, they're trying to be productive. So they're not trying to be malicious. They just know that, no, like you're worth everything that you deserve. But for me, the nature of the stuff I'm talking about is like, I feel a certain type of way when this happens, but I don't know how to bring this up in conversation. And I feel kind of insecure bringing it up. Have you ever dealt with this sort of scenario? How did it look for you? But at the end of the day, this is my truth. It doesn't matter how many other people you talk to until you talk to the source. You're never going to get your answer unless you are able to communicate with the person that you're with. If you can't bring up and have these hard conversations with the person you're with, it doesn't matter what advice you get from other people because they're not experiencing what you're experiencing. They're not experiencing what the other person's experiencing. So you have to acknowledge that, like, even if you quote unquote get advice from your friends, you're then just projecting whatever their situation is onto your experience. And that's not fair to your partner because your situation's different. Everybody's circumstance is different. And
Yep.
you have to be able to have those hard conversations in order to get your relationship to a place of like mutual trust, respect, and understanding.
And on that note, because that right there is dope advice that people need to let that marinate. So that's the best way to end the podcast on. What the fuck is that? I had my Bluetooth on, so that's what you're hearing in the background. Bluetooth speaker.
So it was meant
Turn
to be anyway.
It was what? Yeah.
It was meant to be anyway. It was perfect timing.
It is
Yeah.
perfect timing.
We'll talk about
So,
part two for sure.
all right. Yeah, I'll definitely hit you up. All right. I would like to do it sooner rather than later, because while everything's fresh in my head and it's going to be very interesting. So let me know. Hit me up. Let me know what day and time is good for you, and let's do the part two of this.
Word.
I want to, thank you so much for coming on here, and being a guest and sharing, that part of your life, with me, with the listeners. So I really appreciate that. And once again, we're gonna do the part two of this.
Thank you. I appreciate being here, and I'm grateful that you invited me.
Oh, anytime. There's gonna be many more. There'll be many more. All right. Hey, Sheena, have a good night.
You too. Looking forward to part two.
Absolutely.
Bye.
All right. Talk to you later. Good and bad.